We've come to James chapter 4 and verse 13. And I plan to cover from chapter 4, verse 13 through verse 6, since part of the lesson of the last part of chapter 4 is that we should make our plans and dependence on God. I'm not promising I'm going to get through chapter 5, verse 6. So that's, of course, always the attitude we take. But I'm going to read chapter 4 of James, beginning at verse 13. "Come now, you who say, 'Today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell, and make a profit,' whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, 'If the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that.' But now you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Therefore, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches are corrupted and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver are corroded, and their corrosion will be a witness against you and will eat your flesh like fire. You have heaped up treasure in the last days. Indeed, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, cry out, and the cries of the reapers have reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. You have lived on the earth in pleasure and luxury. You have fattened your hearts as in a day of slaughter. You have condemned, you have murdered the just. He does not resist you." Now, I remember from last week and preceding weeks that in this part of chapter 4, James has been talking about strife within the church, wars and fights he talks about at the beginning of chapter 4. And he points to the cause of those wars and fights, which are selfish ambition and envy. And especially later on in chapter 4, we saw that he points to what you might call the root cause, which is pride. And so he calls us to humble ourselves before God. He quotes from Proverbs, "God resists the proud but gives grace to the humble." And that point of warning against pride seems to be carried over into the section that I just read. So both the last part of chapter 4 and verses 13 and following and the first part of chapter 5 have to do with sins which come from pride. Now, they're also connected, these two particularly are connected with the use of wealth. And so you have businessmen in chapter 4, beginning at verse 13, who make plans and presume on the providence of God. And that's one theme. But then beginning at verse 1 of chapter 5, there are severe denunciations of the wicked wealthy. And that theme then of wealth seems to tie these two together. However, having said that, it's actually hard to pluck these out of context. So verse 7 of chapter 5, which I didn't read, says, "Therefore," and it's a consolation to those who have suffered under the hand of the oppressor and those generally who need to be consoled to look to the coming of the Lord. So it's, in some ways it's sort of an awkward division, but it seems to be a good place to make a break. So let's look then at the first section in chapter 4, verses 13 through 17. This has to do, as I said, with apparently a businessman, those who make plans, and they say in verse 13 what they're going to do. "Today or tomorrow we're going to go to a city, a certain city they have in mind. They're going to spend a year there, make transactions, and make a profit." Right? So that's the context, and in fact, James is here reflecting actual growth in this sort of merchant industry, if you want to call it that, this sort of trading, which was occurring in his time. We might think of the world as mainly agricultural, but in fact, there was a growing class of people who traded in this way, who went to various places and bought and sold. And it sounds innocent enough, doesn't it? This is one of these statements in James where the hearers could well have said, "What's wrong?" Just as when they let the rich man and the poor man into their service, and they told the rich man to sit here and the poor man to sit there. And James denounced them for that. They could have said, huh, what did we do? What's wrong? So it's the same sort of thing here. James is calling us to reflect on a common practice, whether you're a businessman or not, and causing us to think about the way we make plans. Gordon Keddy, who has a series of sermons on James, I think I've mentioned it before, talks about the especially modern tendency to rely on planning, to be obsessed with planning. And he puts, I think, a good perspective on this passage that I thought I'd like to read at the beginning. He said, men want to be like God, knowing the end from the beginning, and in their conceit will take comfort from their own speculations about things to come, and imagine that they can ignore God, who is absolutely sovereign in his overarching providential plan for human history. Okay, so that's something of the bigger picture of what James is getting at. And he goes on to spell out, well, I want to go through how he spells that out. First, notice that he says in verse 13, you who say. Okay, so James is concerned with the use of the tongue, and here, it's, as I pointed out, these sound like innocent enough words. But the contrast in verse 13 between you who say, and then in verse 15, but you ought to say. Okay, so these are people who are just reflecting the thoughts of their own heart, and they're making plans. And the presumptuous aspect of it is pointed out when you read on in the next verse, whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow. These are fellows who are planning a year ahead of time, and they don't know whether they're going to be alive tomorrow. That's the first point that James makes. You do not know what is going to happen tomorrow. There are actually a couple of others. Second of all, you don't know what your life is. That is, it's a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. So we can't plan a year ahead of time. We don't even know what's going to happen tomorrow. We don't even know how long we're going to be alive. We are completely dependent on God and His sustaining hand. In connection with this, you might think of the story that Jesus told of the rich fool. Remember, he had done very well in that case, agricultural business, and he decided he needed to build bigger barns to store his food. And he said to himself, he had many goods laid up for many years. This is in Luke 12, 16 through 21. Many goods laid up for many years. And how long did he live? God said to him, fool, this night your soul will be before me. You will be standing before me. You will have to give an account before God. So that's the sort of presumptuous attitude that is behind the simple-sounding statements of planning. We're going to do this, we're going to make a profit, and so on. What James says is that they should say, if the Lord wills. Now, this phrase, if the Lord wills, is actually one that occurs repeatedly in Scripture. I put up only some of the references, beginning in Acts 18:21, in several places, when godly men are making plans, they say, well, if God wills, this will happen. And that's this idea that James brings forth here. He doesn't say you shouldn't plan, but he says that when you do these things, you should say, if the Lord wills. Now, you're probably aware that this idea of saying, if the Lord wills, has been passed over to an abbreviation, DV. Many people will add it to their letters or, I guess, emails. Or I guess even text messages, I don't know. But DV is short for the Latin phrase, which means God willing. So James is calling us to what actually Gordon Keddy, again, has a helpful phrase here. He says he's calling us to a holy tentativeness. Okay, so there is a form of confidence which is presumptuous and arrogance. And there is a form of tentativeness which is holy. And that's what James is really calling us to. We should realize that our plans are ultimately in God's hand, and He's the one who establishes the plans. How can we expect to buy and sell and make a profit if what we sing in Psalm 127 is true? Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain that build it. Unless the Lord keeps the city, the watchmen watch in vain. That sort of holy tentativeness is then what James is calling us to. Now, it should be clear that planning itself is not bad. Favorite example in Proverbs, go to the ant, thou sluggard, right? The ant, planning may not be quite the right word for the ant, but the ant does make preparation, right? And it works, the reference in Proverbs 6 and 30. The ant labors in summer to get ready for winter. So James is not denying that there's a need for preparation. Basically, business would be impossible without that sort of thing. But he is calling us to the sort of attitude which depends on God. And he gets at that attitude in verse 16, but now you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Okay, but just to see how this works in the wisdom literature, hold your finger there and turn back with me to Proverbs chapter 27 and verse 1. And while we're turning there, I'm going to ask, does anyone else think it's warm in here? Perfect. Oh, okay. I saw one person nod their head. Logan, would you maybe prop it open a little more? And then when you get really cold, raise your hand and he'll close it. Thank you. That's great. Thanks. So Proverbs 27:1, we've mentioned several times how James draws on the wisdom literature, and his is a good example. Proverbs 27:1, do not boast about tomorrow, for you do not know what a day may bring forth. That's an interesting combination, is it? Because we don't usually think of planning confidently as boasting. But it is boasting, because it's essentially saying that I can control what happens. It's essentially putting ourselves in the place of the sovereign God. And that's, so you can go back to James, that's why James says all such boasting is evil. Okay? What seemed like an innocuous business plan could, depending on the state of the heart, actually be classified as evil boasting. Now, this doesn't mean that you have to say DV every time you plan something. Okay, James is after the attitude of the heart. I put up one reference, Romans 15:24. I'm sure there are plenty of others where Paul says he's going to do something and doesn't say if the Lord wills. It's not as if that's some sort of incantation or charm which blesses all of your plans. Okay, it's like adding, you know, in Jesus' name at the end of the prayer somehow makes it right. It is the attitude of the heart that James is after. And maybe we can get at it this way. When we laugh, and when we were watching Expelled, I guess it's appropriate to say we were laughing at the naturalistic evolution point of view, which somehow believes that somehow the universe and all of its complexity could come about by pure chance plus time. It seems absolutely ridiculous to believe that, besides being contrary to the scriptures. But James might well ask us, do you actually live that way? Do you, in practice, deny that the hand of God has anything to do with your affairs? Do you live as if you can control everything? Do you live as a sort of practical atheist in denial that God's hand of providence is on everything? That's the sort of searching question that James would have us to think about. Businessmen, in particular, might be tempted to this sort of thing. You have to have a certain amount of confidence if you're in business. If you don't believe in your product or service, you can't expect anyone else to believe in it. Okay? So that's quite reasonable. And the temptation then, especially for the businessmen, is to arrogantly assume that whatever he plans to do, he can bring about. He will make a profit. That was the plan that they made. But the same thing is true of us, whatever our profession is, whatever our calling is. It also applies to churches. Gordon Keddy, again, is actually a native of Scotland, and so he has a particular perspective, having ministered in the U.S. for several years. And he's noticed in America a certain triumphalism, where churches make these grandiose plans for what God is going to do for them. And they may formally say DV, but the attitude might be quite different. It might be a foolish and vain self-confidence. So that's the sort of thing that James is then getting at the conclusion. Verse 17 doesn't seem to fit exactly at first glance with the rest of the passage. Verse 17 is actually a general statement, and there are places like this in James where James makes a very general statement, which is linked to a specific context. To him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin. If you know what you profess to know about the providence of God, if you really believe God is sovereign, if you really believe that, you know, everything comes from him, then it's sinful if you don't actually act on it. Here he's talking about sins of omission. You know these things, but you should do them. That's a familiar idea from James, who stressed that back in chapter 2. And James is here calling us to live according to our profession, and in particular to Calvinists, should I say, to actually act as practical Calvinists, believing that God is sovereign and living with a certain holy tentativeness. Do you have any comments or questions on that section?
I think I'll throw away my lesson plans for the
week. Yeah, right. So that's the, yeah. The sort of wrong reaction would be to say, oh, let's not make any plans. And that actually does appeal to some of us also. But right. Go to the ants. How's that? Someone else was going to say something. Yeah, Logan.
I think in one of Jonathan Edwards' sermons, he phrased it as not depending on tomorrow, but planning for tomorrow, which I like that play on words and that distinction there.
That's very helpful. Yeah, that's right. And it's especially that dependence on tomorrow and not on the sovereign God that James is calling us, warning us against. Okay, but let's look at the next section then. And there is, even though there is, as I mentioned before, a common theme of warning against pride and the connection with wealth, there is a sharp transition here. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. Okay. Now, what James is doing in verses 1 through 6 of chapter 5 is warning the unbelieving rich of the judgment that will come upon them. Now, I say that because one could, I suppose, try to interpret this in terms of James warning the rich believers among the church. But it doesn't seem that he's addressing believers within the church. He frequently uses the word brethren, and here he just addresses them as you rich. Okay? And there are other suggestions that James doesn't think in those terms. Earlier in chapter 1, he had spoken about the rich believer and the poor believer, and they each had their own responsibilities, their own responses to God's word that were appropriate to their condition. But James doesn't here give any counsel beyond the warning of the wrath of God coming on them. And so I think it here is addressed specifically to the unbelieving rich. Now, if that's the case, there's a question, like, why did you write this? Because they're not going to be reading it. And the first thing probably in response to that is just to remember that there are many passages like this in the Old Testament prophets. Our pastor's been preaching through Isaiah, so we've seen again and again passages in the prophets that are addressed to various nations. They would not at least have been the immediate recipients of those addresses from Isaiah and the other prophets. But they serve their own purpose. Here especially the purpose would be, first of all, to comfort believers who are being oppressed. And that comfort especially comes in the verses that follow. As I noted, beginning at verse 7, James turns and addresses the believers. But he, first of all, assures believers that those who are oppressing them, and apparently they were being oppressed by these wealthy unbelievers, that God will judge them. So that's the first point he makes. And second, or if it's a second point or the same sort of point, is that he comforts them in that God does know their condition. Okay, God hears, and it would be a very disturbing thing to someone who knew the Old Testament to hear that the cries of the reapers have gone to the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. That's God as the Lord of armies. Okay, that's a terrifying thought, to realize that God is sending his armies against you. And so that, but on the other hand, that would be a comfort to the believers who knew that God knew their condition. But also, and Calvin makes this point, I think, well, this is a warning to all believers not to envy the condition of the wealthy. Okay? We might not like, if we're poor, the fact that they oppress us, but we might also secretly wish that we were in their place, or at least that we had that kind of money, and then we would do good things with it, or something like that. But there is implicit in this also a warning against envy and the desire to have the sort of wealth that is here represented. So that's something of the background. James, as I said, speaks in the style of the Old Testament prophets. This weeping and howling are words that are used in the Old Testament. They're actually examples of the literary figure called onomatopoeia, which is a great word in itself. It just means that when you read the word, it sounds like, in Greek, it sounds like weeping and howling. Both of the words have that sort of sound to them. James is speaking as an Old Testament prophet and warning them, first of all, of the judgment, and then it seems maybe a little odd to us, but after saying what judgment will come on them, he gives the reason for the judgment to come on them. So, first of all, he talks about what will happen to them, and he warns them of the miseries that are coming on them. Okay. So, what are the warnings? Well, first of all, he says that the wealth that they have put up will not last. He says in verse 2, your riches are corrupted, your garments are moth-eaten, your gold and silver are corroded. Now, this sort of statement, that is, that wealth does not last, is, again, a common theme in Scripture, probably because we tend to think that our wealth will last, at least as long as we do, or that we can take it with us, to use a common phrase. So I put up several references there, Job and Isaiah, but let's turn to Matthew 6:19 to see. Again, here James uses the language from Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount in this case, and as we'll see later on, possibly from the Gospel of Luke, the same sort of allusion. Matthew 6:19, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where the thieves do not break in and steal. Right? So there is, it is clear to us that garments can be moth-eaten. Even when you put them in mothballs, they can be moth-eaten. But what's interesting is that James actually says your gold and silver are corroded or rusted. Gold and silver don't rust. Okay, and some people have said James was plain ignorant, you know, some country bumpkin. But I don't think so. James has quite proved otherwise, if you were ever concerned about that point. But it is a remarkable statement because it says even the things that we think are most enduring, gold and silver, that's part of the reason they're so valuable, is that they don't corrode. In the end, they won't last. Right? Even those things pass away. And what's worse, they bear witness against the people. They will be a witness against you and will eat your flesh like fire. So James warns that judgment will come on them. And in fact, he refers here, and I'll pick out a few phrases from the verses that follow, but he warns them here that there is a day of judgment coming. He says they have heaped up treasure in the last days. And the phrase the last days has to do with the fullness of time that is on us with the coming of Christ. Okay, when James refers to the last days, he's not counting how many years it's been since the state of Israel was established or something like that. He is looking in biblical theological terms. He's looking at the big picture. With the coming of Christ, the last days are upon us. And there is a judgment imminent then. This will become a theme again in the later part, verse 9. The judge is standing at the door. How foolish it is to be in the last days and hold on to your wealth. Your wealth is going to testify against you in the last days. You're at the end, at the day of judgment. And that same sort of theme, as I said, comes through elsewhere. In verse 4, for example, the reference to the Lord of Sabaoth, or the Lord of hosts, the God of armies, emphasizes the fact that there is a day of judgment coming. And again, I'm sort of skipping ahead. Later on he gives the reasons, but let me point out that theme one more time, and that's in verse 5. You have fattened your hearts as in a day of slaughter. Okay. So, you know, we have a phrase in English that if you make a good profit, you've made a killing. And I suppose if James had that, he could use a play on words here. The day of killing is going to be taken in another sense. It is a day of great judgment that's going to be coming on you. The day of slaughter. And you can think of all the Old Testament imagery of the coming of the Lord as a great warrior king who slaughters his enemies. Or in the book of Revelation with the great destruction in chapters 18 and 19. It's a terrifying picture, but that's exactly what James is trying to communicate to the wicked wealthy. They trust in their treasure. They think it will last. He says it will burn or eat your flesh like fire, and you are facing a great last judgment. He goes on to condemn four things about the wealthy. Okay, I'll make this point later, but he is not condemning wealth as such. He is not condemning all wealthy people as wicked. I think that's clear from what we already saw in chapter 1. I want to come back to that point because it's a little easy for us to slide out of any application if we think too much about that at the beginning. So let's think about the four points that he makes, the four reasons that they are to be condemned. First of all, he says you have heaped up treasure in the last days. And this has to do with the idea of hoarding. They're hoarding their wealth. And in particular, it emphasizes this selfishness that we already saw was present in the church, and James refers to it earlier in chapters 3 and 4. But here it's magnified to a great extent. You know, hoarding is sort of an interesting thing. This is maybe a trivial example, but I was working in the nursery. This was not at our church. It was actually the international conference many years ago when we had children who were that age. And there was this one kid in there who would gather all the toys to himself, but he wouldn't play with them. He'd just sit there and hold on to them. And if anyone tried to come up and get one of them, well, of course, you know what would happen. No, he couldn't talk. But he wouldn't play with them. And that, in some ways, isn't that a picture of every person who hoards whatever it is he has? And that's the first condemnation, that they are heaping up treasure. Calvin makes an interesting point here. He goes on from, so not Calvin, but James goes on from this to the second condemnation, which is refusing to pay the laborers. Okay, there was a purpose for the use of the money they gathered, and part of it was to be giving a fair wage to the laborers, not to hold back the money. And I think part of the point that James is making is that those are connected. I'm listing four reasons, but they're actually connected with each other. God doesn't give us our wealth just for us to heap up. God gives us our wealth for a particular purpose, and part of it is to make use of it for the good of others. So Calvin says, now my quotation from Calvin has disappeared. Yeah, okay. James speaks to those whose manner of life is... This is actually connected with the later point he makes about living in luxury, but it works here. James speaks to those whose manner of life is fine and expansive, yet they would rather see their store of possessions wasted before their eyes than let it out for necessary employment. Some have such a spite in their characters that it hurts them to share daylight or fresh air with other folk. Okay, a very picturesque statement from Calvin. Some people even want to hoard the light and the fresh air. They don't want to share the wealth that God has given. And that's the picture here of their wealth. And the heaping up of the treasure is specifically said in the end of verse 3, in the last days. That's an amazing thing. The day of judgment is coming, and you think your wealth is going to do you any good? Why would you heap it up? Why would you hoard it when, in fact, you're defrauding others and the judge is at the door? That's the first condemnation. The second is about the defrauding of the laborers. In verse 4, he has, again, a specific to his own context, an agricultural reference. At that time, there was a growth of folks who had a lot of land, and therefore a growth in farmers not having land of them their own to work, but working land for others. Now, this sort of feudal system, of course, developed in Europe at various at a later stage. But here, what he's referring to especially is those who mowed your fields, but he says the wages of those people you kept back by fraud. Now, exactly what James has in mind is a little unclear, but if we look at a couple of Old Testament references, I think we can spell this out. So turn back with me to Leviticus. See, I didn't actually plan this connection, but it's turned out to be helpful that we did study Leviticus, at least parts of it, for James. So Leviticus chapter 19, a chapter with the great the second great commandment, love your neighbor as yourself. And in Leviticus 19 and verse 13, there's a warning. We discussed this when we looked at this chapter. There are lots of things in the chapter, but one thing that we did pick out was this warning about the paying the poor promptly. You shall not cheat your neighbor nor rob him. The wages of him who is hired shall not remain with you all night until morning. Okay, so it's actually the same idea of cheating and robbing the neighbor in Leviticus 19:13 as in the book of James. And the specific example in Leviticus of that sort of defrauding is holding back wages. As we discussed then, that might not mean a lot to us, but if you're living on the margins, if you're extremely poor, then you need your pay at the end of the day's work, right? And that's part of what's going on in Jesus' parable where the men are promised a certain pay, and some who come later in the day are paid the same amount as everyone else. But they remember, they all come back at the end of the day and they receive their wages. And that, again, that may not connect with us. I get paid monthly and we can get by with that. But if you're really impoverished, then being paid every night is an important thing. You're paid for your day's work. So that could be the sort of thing that James has in mind. He doesn't spell it out, but I'd like to look at one other reference, and this in Jeremiah 22:13. Here again, you can see the connection between great wealth and defrauding, right? You might think that it's the person who's not all that rich who would seek to get by and cheat the laborer. But actually, it's the people who have spacious chambers, as it says in verse 14 of Jeremiah 22, who are doing this sort of thing. Jeremiah 22, I'll read 13 and 14. Woe to him who builds his house by unrighteousness and his chambers by injustice, who uses his neighbor's service without wages and gives him nothing for his work. So you can see the connection there with James, who says, I will build myself a wide house with spacious chambers and cut out windows for it, paneling it with cedar and painting it with vermilion. And then this is a really fascinating passage, because Jeremiah goes on and it becomes clear that he's addressing the king. He's rebuking the king for exactly this sort of living and contrasting him with the righteous his righteous forefather. So we can go back to James now. You can see just from those two examples that there was a rich Old Testament background. There's a huge amount of material in the Old Testament about not oppressing the poor, and especially about not defrauding the worker, paying the worker promptly, making sure the wages are fit for their work, and so on. And the New Testament echoes that. We looked at that. Actually, we didn't have a lot of time to look at that in Leviticus 19. But it's something that carries over into the New Testament as well. So James says, when you do this sort of thing, then the cries of the reapers who are crying against this oppression reach the ears of the Lord of hosts. So this Sabaoth is the word that's used in the Old Testament of, which is usually translated Lord of Hosts or Lord of Armies. And James is saying that the wages cry out and the reapers cry out. Just like the blood of Abel cried out and bore witness against Cain, so here the cries come before the ears of God. In fact, one of the references we skipped over in Deuteronomy 24 says the same thing. It's intended to give a serious warning, as I mentioned before, to anyone who would attempt something like that. You have an overlord too, he is saying to the wealthy. And if you defraud those who are underneath you, then your overlord will take it up with you. And it will be a serious matter when he sends his armies against you. So that's the second of the condemnations that James brings, or reasons for condemnation that he brings. The third has to do with a self-indulgent lifestyle, and that's described in verse 5. You've lived on the earth in pleasure and luxury. Now, this is, of course, connected with the idea of hoarding the wealth. That is, well, they spent some of it, but whatever they spent was all on themselves and all for pleasure and luxury. And here, I think it would be helpful if we think about this in terms of one story that Jesus gives, and that's in Luke chapter 16. So keep your finger there, but turn back with me to Luke 16. This is this account that Jesus gives of the rich man and Lazarus. Isn't it interesting that the rich man is never named in this account? Only Lazarus, the poor man, is. So I'm not going to read the account to you, but you're, I think, familiar with it. There is, I'll read the opening verses so you can see the connection with James. There was a certain rich man who was clothed in purple and fine linen and fared sumptuously every day. So there's the self-indulgence that James is talking about. But there was a certain beggar named Lazarus, full of sores, who was laid at his gate, desiring to be fed with the crumbs which fell from the rich man's table. Moreover, the dogs came and licked his sores. Now this is the sort of contrast that James is talking about. The one who is clothed in purple and fine linen and who fared sumptuously every day. And notice the same sort of contrast that James makes. You have lived on the earth in pleasure and luxury. That's in contrast with the judgment to come. And that's exactly what Abraham says in verse 25 to this rich man. And I'm still in Luke 16. But Abraham said, "Son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things. You lived on the earth in great wealth and abundance," Abraham is saying in essence. "And likewise, Lazarus, evil things. But now he is comforted and you are tormented." So that's the sort of picture that James has in mind. And in fact, behind probably even Jesus' description of the rich man and Lazarus is a description in Ezekiel. I think we won't turn there, but Ezekiel 16:49. We think of Sodom especially for the sin of sodomy and its judgment for that reason. But in fact, Ezekiel 16 gives a little bit of background on that sin. And it was exactly the same sort of luxurious living and oppression of the poor, which was also accompanied with the abomination of sodomy. So that, which actually may have a lot to say to our own culture, by the way. But that background then is, I think, what's going on in James 5. So now we can finally go back to James chapter 5 and verse 5. He addresses those who have been oppressing the poor, and as I noted in the quote from Calvin, there is a connection there between the oppression of the poor and those who live on the earth in pleasure and luxury. God didn't give us our wealth simply to hoard it up or spend it on ourselves, but we should also have a regard for the poor and needy. And then, as we noted before, he refers to them as fattening their hearts as in a day of slaughter. Okay, so it's a very picturesque language. Just the way you fatten cattle for the slaughter, so you're nicely fattening yourselves for the day of God's judgment by this self-indulgent attitude. It's a very disturbing picture that James is painting of these self-indulgent, unbelieving, wicked, wealthy people. And then the fourth condemnation is in verse 6. You yourselves have condemned. You have murdered the just. He does not resist you. Now, the word that's used there for condemned is a legal term. And it probably means then that the wealthy people took advantage of their power in the legal system to oppress the poor. So not only did they defraud the laborers of their wages, but they manipulated the court system to have their own way. Again, this we talked about this in Leviticus. There were laws in the Old Testament which prevented this accumulation of land long term. And I'm not arguing, I said then that those laws don't necessarily continue over, but there were always ways for people to manipulate the legal system to get around that, and to accumulate land and to condemn the poor. And that's what James is talking about here. He talks about not only that, but actually murdering the just, whether it was actual murder that was committed, or that is directly, or starvation, which would have led to murder, or simply the sort of hatred and arrogant indifference, which would be equivalent to murder. In any case, James says that they are guilty of that also. That's the fourth condemnation, a fourth reason why they will be judged. And James adds that they do not resist you, whether they're unable to resist you because of your power or because they meekly submit the way Christ did to those who condemned him. That idea of resistance and the patient waiting is spelled out further in the rest of James, so I'm not going to go further on that point. But I want to think a little bit now about how this applies. This passage, as I said, is addressed to unbelieving wealthy people. And for that reason, we may think it has nothing to say to us. After all, we don't do these sorts of things. But it is here for a reason. And one of the reasons is to warn us not to envy the wicked and not to have this same point of view, not to trust in riches. Let me get at it in what may seem like sort of a strange way at first, but I have a point. And that is to note that James is here using the Bible's teaching about eschatology, that is the end times, to rebuke the rich. Now, that may seem a little like sort of a strange point to make, but in fact, many people who have been critics of Christianity have pointed out that sometimes people have taught the gospel to the poor just to give them a pie-in-the-sky hope so they'll be easily manipulated. So African slaves in America, for example, were taught the gospel, and secular historians say, well, that had the effect of pacifying them. You promise them heaven, and then they'll work like dogs for you, and that sort of thing. What's remarkable here is that James actually uses the same promise of the coming of God as a reason to condemn exactly that sort of oppression. And it's very clear here that James is warning the wicked that it's inconsistent with the teachings of the scriptures to act in that way. They will stand before the great judge. Now, I make that point because, unhappily, in the history of the church, that point has been ignored. So, again and again, people have lived within the church with great wealth and have used it for ill ends or heaped it up for themselves. There's a whole section in Calvin's Institutes, interestingly enough, on the way the Roman church used or misused its wealth. And he has some very interesting stories from the early church of people using the wealth of the church to care for the poor. And Calvin points out how that was abandoned. Calvin himself is unwilling to let the people who misuse wealth get by. But there is an important point here that I made at the beginning, and that is that this does not condemn all wealth. And again, I thought I would read from what Calvin says. This is actually from what he says on his in that passage in Luke that we read. And I think it'll help us to think through applying this to ourselves. Calvin says, but this must not be taken sorry, let me back up a little bit. In referring to the condemnation on the rich man as opposed to Lazarus, Calvin says, he is said to be tormented in hell because he received his good things in this world. But this must not be taken as meaning that eternal destruction awaits all those who live well and prosperously in the world. In fact, as Augustine shrewdly observed, the pauper Lazarus is carried into the bosom of wealthy Abraham to teach us that the gate of the kingdom of heaven is shut against no rich man, but lies open for all in common who either have used their riches well or have been patient in poverty. All it means is that he who was completely sunk in the pleasures and delights of this present life and so despised God and his kingdom is now given the punishment of his sloth. I like that observation of Augustine that Lazarus was received into Abraham's bosom. Abraham was a wealthy man himself when he lived on the earth. So the danger for us is to say, well, we're not like those people, and therefore this passage in James doesn't apply to us. But we are relatively wealthy compared to earlier parts of the history of the world. We're probably extremely wealthy. And there is a warning in Scripture again and again that there are great snares with wealth. So I want to conclude by looking at one passage in 1 Timothy that I think will help us to think through applying this to ourselves. And that's in 1 Timothy chapter 6. There are actually two places in the chapter where Paul takes this up. And it's remarkable that Paul touches on many of the same points as James does and of course coming to the heart matter. So let me read first in 1 Timothy 6, beginning at verse 6. He's just talked about those who suppose that godliness is a means of gain. And he says in verse 6, 1 Timothy chapter 6, "Now godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. And having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and harmful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, from which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness, and pierced themselves through with many sorrows." Now, if you read just that, I suppose you could think that Paul was telling all of the wealthy who received his letter to go out and sell all they had. But, of course, that's not what he's saying. So let's go down to verse 17. "Command those who are rich in this present age not to be haughty, nor to trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God who gives us richly all things to enjoy. Let them do good, that they may be rich in good works, ready to give, willing to share, storing up for themselves a good foundation for the time to come, that they may lay hold on eternal life." This actually is a good reflection on both of the passages we looked at from James, both the not presuming on God's providential care and our own business endeavors, as well as the not trusting in riches. So Paul says that those who are rich are not to be haughty and not to trust in riches, but in God. Maybe that's the biggest temptation of all. And as we noted before, maybe that's why James so often calls on the poor as those who have learned to trust in God, because they have no material wealth to trust in on their own. The poor have their own temptations. But notice how Paul gives the remedy for that, and that is to do good, to be rich not only in these riches of this world, but also rich in good works. And that means ready to give and willing to share. And that has in store in mind again the coming judgment, because he says we're storing up for ourselves a good foundation for the time to come, that they may lay hold on eternal life. So Paul calls us, just as James would if he were speaking more expansively on the proper use of wealth, he calls us to trust in God and not to hoard, but to make good use of what God has given us. Well, obviously, that's a big subject. James has a particular focus on the wicked wealthy. A lot more could be said on the use of our wealth as believers. And you'll probably say it when you have the chance. Any comments or questions on this? Yeah. Any other comments? Okay, let's close in prayer.